Good evening and welcome. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and welcome to our members' room for the first event of our fall programs here at the Society Library. Welcome to all our members, our trustees who are here, and if you're a guest of a member, then welcome as well. And if you're interested in membership information in the library, speak to me after. Before I introduce our speaker, Merrill Gordon, let me please remind you to take out your cell phones, pagers, any device, including an iPad, anything that will make an electronic noise, and everyone will appreciate it if you silence it for the next hour. The Society Library relies on our friends for support above and beyond their membership fees, which cover only 27% of our operating budget. Our fall fundraising appeal is on right now, and we're raising money to support our collections, to run our children's library up on the third floor, to continue building our collection of books, periodicals, databases, and to pay for events just like tonight's program. Thank you in advance for considering a gift to the library, and if you've given already this September, then definitely thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to introduce our lecturer, Merrill Gordon, who I can also proudly say is a member of the Society Library. She's been with us since 1996. She is the author of Mrs. Astor Regrets, The Hidden Betrayals of a Family Beyond Reproach, from 2006. She's an award-winning journalist whose articles have appeared in the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and New York Magazine. And she is the director of magazine writing at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. If you've not read her new book, The Phantom of Fifth Avenue, you are certainly in for a treat. This is a fascinating and well-researched biography of Huguette Clark, the youngest daughter of Montana robber baron William Andrews Clark. Mrs. Clark, who passed at the age of 104, lived her later years hidden from public sight, cared for, and it would seem, happy in a hospital here in New York City. I'm sure you have many questions for our speaker tonight, and we will have a good, generous time for questions and answers after the lecture. Our friends from the corner bookstore are outside and will gladly sell you a copy of the biography. So please join me in welcoming Merrill Gordon.
Very important thing. Everyone can hear me, I've learned. Well, first, thank you, Mark, and I want to thank Sarah. I'm thrilled to be here. It's, as you know, one of the world's most beautiful buildings, and I certainly have spent, and my husband, Walter Shapiro, in the corner, we spent a lot of time doing research here. I have two books out now related to, one's a magazine piece, one's a new book I'm starting. So I'm very grateful to the Society Library and for just being a wonderful part of New York. Coming here tonight, what's interesting to me for the two books I've written, first about Brooke Astor and now about Huguette Clark, this is physically probably the closest I've ever been to, it's like the epicenter of their lives. Brooke Astor lived at 73rd and Park. Huguette Clark's father built what was once the largest private mansion in New York, 121 rooms at 77th, and then when he died and the mansion was torn down, she moved to 72nd Street. So I know they would have walked by this building, maybe they stuck their head in, but I feel like this is very much an Upper East Side book. Now, I should start with a confession that may explain a few things about me and my work. My name is Merrill Gordon, and I read too much Nancy Drew as a child. And my mother is a psychiatric social worker. So I had my dreams analyzed at breakfast. Which brings me to, as a reporter, what interests me is a good mystery, and B, not just it's not just who done it, but why did they do it, how did they do it, what were all the moments that happened that came to this moment. Just a couple of brief comparisons about my two subjects, who in some ways could not have been more different, but had some similarities. Brooke Astor was born in 1902. Huguette was born in 1906. Both of them married men from Princeton. Neither of them went to college. Both divorced men from Princeton. And they had very different attitudes towards the world, because I think, as you remember, Brooke Astor went out virtually every single night in New York. I mean, her picture was in the Bill Cunningham, you know. So when I began that book, there were a million people to write about, to talk to. And with Huguette, it was a locked door mystery. What happened to someone? How could a woman worth so much money spend 20 years in a hospital room when she wasn't sick? So for me, it was kind of, it was such a different experience, because the first time I was wandering into fabulous Upper East Side living rooms with amazing art, and this time it was really trying to track down people who'd known her a long time ago, people who, you know, I found a childhood playmate of hers, 92 years old, in a nursing home in Charleston. That was a really interesting interview. I found many other people, but it was a very different experience. I think one of the biggest differences between the two of them, though, is that Brooke Astor married money. And she married money when she was in her 50s, when she married Vincent Astor. So she had time to become Mrs. Brooke Astor. Huguette inherited money. She was born with it. And I realized that, essentially, it's a very different experience to grow up famous and rich than it is to grow into your world. Now, I got involved with this book. Huguette died in May 2011. And I literally got a call from a publisher within a week after she died, because the Astor book had done well, and I'm a middle-class Jewish girl from Rochester, New York. I'm now the go-to biographer for centenarians from the Social Register. And in fact, I've just started a book on Bunny Mellon, so it's my trifecta. But it's such a fascinating, interesting world. You know, it's both the opportunities that were not available, and it's sort of fun diving back into whether it's the jazz age or understanding, you know, just a different mores. Anyhow, I got a call saying, would I do this book? And here's what we knew right when she died. Big page one New York Times story saying she was a recluse. That she was the daughter of William Andrews Clark, who was a copper baron based in Montana. He'd made his money in Farmer's Son, went out west to make his fortune, discovered it was a whole lot that mining, digging, you know, digging out there in the woods was not a lot of fun, but that you could actually make a lot of money if you supplied the mine. So he became initially a merchant, then a banker. He was married twice, which I'll come back to later. Huguette was from his second family. And he was elected to the Senate by the state legislature. And then there were charges of corruption. He had bribed the legislature, so he was sort of not seated in Washington. And then he went back and basically made nice to everyone in the state legislature, legitimately elected. So we knew, you know, here is Huguette. Her father's one of the richest men in America. He was considered to be second wealthiest after John D. Rockefeller in his day. And no one really knew anything about her, that she had essentially been a very popular debutante but then vanished into the shadows, and that in 1991 she went into the hospital for skin cancer, and then she never came out. Even though, again, she could have gone home after a few months. So really, the question for me was trying to figure out, you know, what happened to this young woman who was the debutante of her year and was popular and much loved. Like, when you start any book, there's a certain amount of just thrashing around trying to figure out what you're doing. And that very first summer, Walter and I went out to Montana. And while Huguette never lived in Butte full time, her father had a house there. She was there all the time. And it's now a bed and breakfast. So that was me at 3 o'clock in the morning, walking around, you know, down the hallway. Huguette, you know, what happened to you? What did you think? What did you feel? I was very lucky both early in the research and late in the research, and I cannot begin to tell you how much luck goes into reporting. Very early on, two people who were close to Huguette agreed to cooperate with me. One was her assistant for 20 years, Chris. And Chris loved her, cared about her, worked in her apartment, saw her all the time, and he had not talked to other journalists, and he kind of decided that he would trust me. So that was enormously helpful, because he really could talk about, you know, he began, I think he was so upset by some of the news portrayals had said that Huguette, you know, they made her sound like she had, serious mental problems. She was playing with her doll. She was eccentric, but she wasn't crazy, and that she was very smart. And then the other person who agreed to talk to me was her goddaughter, a woman named Wanda Stika. Wanda, interesting woman. Wanda's father was one of the most famous portrait painters working in America in the 1920s and 30s, Tade Stika. There's still his portrait of Teddy Roosevelt is in the Roosevelt Room at the White House. He did Marion Davies. He did every sort of major famous person. And he painted 11. Huguette's father was, shall we say, a little bit of an ego. He commissioned 11 portraits of himself. 11. And his wife and his children. And when Huguette wanted to take painting lessons, she took them with Tade. So when Wanda initially agreed to talk to me, that was pretty fabulous. I talked to a lot of people in the course of this book, but I had an amazing experience that happened last fall. I think, as many of you know, the family had a lawsuit against, to try to break her will. And when that lawsuit was settled, and I had spent a lot of time in the previous couple of years making very nice to lawyers, it's part of one of these things you make nice to lawyers. Much to my amazement, I got the New York Attorney General's office, the public administrator, the copyright lawyer, and the lawyer for the family to allow me to do something rather amazing. Huguette had saved everything, and they had carted out 75 boxes of documents from her apartment. And I sat for 3 days in Milbank Tweed going through documents. It was Huguette's childhood diary. It was letters from her husband. It was letters after their divorce from her husband. It was receipts from Cartier and Tiffany's. It was powerful letters among family members over major things that had happened. I mean, I literally, there were points I was sitting there weeping as I kind of learned more about. So that gives you the overview of where I came from. So let me talk a little bit about Huguette's life and kind of what led to those moments. Now, as I mentioned earlier, her father was married twice, and first wife was his childhood playmate, and she died after getting typhoid fever at the World's Fair in 1893. Thank you, Walter. See, this is what happens when you write a book. You forget some of these things. My very own heckler, it's great, or fact checker, as you might put it. He had 4 surviving children from his first marriage, and he was rattling around the house in Butte. And what does he spy, as he described it, in the 4th of July parade, this gorgeous 15-year-old? 39-year age difference, Anna LaChapelle, and he made Anna his ward. I love that word, ward. First he sent her to boarding school. He was going to support her artistic, she wanted to play the harp. And then after she graduated, he arranged for her to go to Paris. It was supposed to be sort of, her parents were French-Canadian, but she was going to get a Parisian accent, a little glamour. She ended up staying there for almost 15 years. And as I had mentioned, he was elected to the Senate. And there were so many stories he was one of the richest men in America, but he was unbelievably cheap. One of the stories that Walter loves is literally he was in the subway in New York, early subway days, and he lost a penny in a gumball machine. And he missed 4 trains complaining to the station manager. He was very cheap. I mean, there were files of letters of his in which he would basically begrudge almost every penny. He's in the Senate, and he has this secret girlfriend in Paris. And in 1902, she gives birth to a baby girl named Andre. And amazingly enough, of course, we're not in the internet age then, he didn't tell anyone, including the children from his first marriage, who are older than his ward. In 1904, he suddenly decided that maybe he should go public with this event. So he announces to the newspapers that he's been secretly married for 2 years, and he's got this 2-year-old baby. But he'd forgotten that he'd given an interview to his own paper And when he actually gave a wedding date, but the place where he'd given an interview to his paper from had nothing to do with where he said he was married. It was a huge scandal. As you can imagine, the children from his first marriage were not particularly happy about the prospect of having a half-sibling and concerned about their money, their estate, their future. And then Huguette was born 4 years later, and some of these relatives spread stories that she would later hear about, that she was illegitimate, her mother had had an affair, that her father never really loved her. So from the get-go, there was tension between the second family and the first family. The family went back and forth. After he built his mansion, opened in 1911, the family went back and forth. They're mostly based in Paris. And in the summer of 1914, as you remember, there was some events going on in Europe. Huguette and her family were in Paris when World War I began, and they had to flee, and it was sort of fairly traumatic of trying to get out of the... And then they came and stayed here. But Huguette always remembered, she was 8 years old at the time, the kind of fear of leaving. As I was to discover, she went to the Spence School, and when I got to look at all of her, she literally had saved her report cards and her class essays. It was really amazing to be sitting there transported back to that era. But, I had always wondered going into this, because I'd heard so many strange stories, she was really smart. She had good grades. And she wrote this lovely essay called Happy Memories, and it was all about how she loved to travel. She loved the feeling in the train. She liked to get away from, good old, bad old New York. There was just a delightful sense of who she was. In 1919, the family, it was the summer of 1919, there were major events in the life of this family. And I got to discover them by reading the letters the family members sent each other. It was a busy summer because William Andrews Clark had arranged to take his wife, Anna, and Huguette up to Maine, to Ranger Lake, Maine. And Huguette's sister, Andre, who was 16, was going off to spend time with relatives, and then she was going to come up and meet them in Maine. And then the senator had to leave to go to Butte because there was a trial involving one of his various business things. So you read these letters, and there are letters that Andre, older sister, was very bright, lovely, writing to her father, "Oh, Daddy, I can't wait to get up to see you. This is going to be so wonderful, but I'm really enjoying seeing my cousins at the farm and the horses and whatever." And William Randers Clark, who everybody thought was just the nastiest SOB around, was besotted with his family. So it was all about, "I've sent you your favorite cartoons, and this place is magical. Wait till you see the sunsets." And then at one point he's traveling, and Huguette writes him a letter saying, "Oh, Daddy, I miss my sister so much. I can't wait till she gets here. This is just, this is going to be great." And then there are letters when Andre arrives in Maine, and it's, "Daddy, it's just as wonderful as you imagine. I'm so sorry you're not here, but I'm so happy that you're coming for my birthday." And he's writing back saying, "I'm so glad you're," they're just these incredibly affectionate letters. And then there's a telegram. Andre came down with spinal meningitis. She was misdiagnosed by the local doctor. Anna summoned William Andrews Clark, and the telegram was sent to him on the train coming back, "Our daughter's with the angels now. And Huguette does not know yet. And be as brave as our daughter was. She was singing her Girl Scout songs till the end, till she died." Now, Huguette was an impressionable young girl, and one of the things that really got to me again as I was reading through her papers is that year after her sister died, all common psychiatric practice is, you should talk about your feelings, you should write a letter to the person who died, but people weren't doing that sort of thing in those days. Huguette wrote a diary, partly in French, partly in English, to her sister. And it was, saying, and there were even, she had a nickname, Hugo. So she even wrote, "Hugo was very bored at the opera with our parents." But it was her way of trying to grapple with the loneliness. And I was also able, through seeing a variety of letters that William Andrews Clark had, to sort of track where the family was at various points in time. And remember, they have a 121-room mansion. There is Huguette, and her mother goes off to Europe because she's so bereaved. Her father is off doing business in Maine, and this little girl is alone with the servants. You will not be surprised to hear that after this happened, the family became very germphobic. We have Purell. They didn't. The household staff would wipe the doorknobs. They would also wipe the doorknobs when Huguette was, they were traveling, when she went to see friends. So there's a bit of a germ phobia that began, that kind of ebbed, but then came back to her later in life. There were a wonderful series of letters for the next number of years between Huguette and her father. And she was Miss Outdoors. She's writing the letters about going to Hawaii and learning to surf with Duke Kahamamoku, the Olympic champion. And Daddy, you have to see me now. I'm as brown as a berry. I lost an older brother. And if you've lost a sibling, you're desperate to make your parents happy. So Huguette was just so desperate to try to be everything she could be to them, even though obviously you can't replace a sibling who's died. One of the things she had in common with her father was an art collector. He scoured Europe to, bought a lot of bad art, as the Corcoran would later discover, but there were a lot of fakes in his collection, but he also had an amazing art collection. And Huguette would go with him on trips to Europe and to galleries, and he wanted to collect art, she wanted to become an artist. So he arranged for her to take lessons with Tade Stika, who I'd mentioned earlier, who was much older than her, and she had a major crush on as a young woman. Her father died in 1925, and at that point, Huguette became a very rich woman. He divided his estate up between his five children. They each got, it's always hard to guess, but roughly $50 million we're talking about in 1925. And you can imagine the headlines. The headlines were all richest girl in the world. You know, she had been famous essentially from birth. And when I looked at the pictures of her and Andre getting off boats, Andre was always, hi, and Huguette was like, she hated the attention. She hated being famous for no particular reason. And it became, the attention was just really loathsome for her. She graduated from Spence. She was the debutante of the year. And then she married William Gower, whose father had worked for William Andrews Clark. And she would later say to everyone that the wedding night was a disaster, that she didn't really understand what was going on, and she didn't apparently like it very much. It's also, William Gower was paid to marry her. He was given $1 million in a dowry. And again, $1 million is a lot of money in 1928. And as one of the, Charlie Knickerbocker would later write, she gave him the money to feel free, and he felt so free. He would later marry this woman who was kind of like maybe she was the Kardashian of her day, someone who was multiply married and very sexually experienced as compared to Huguette. I found Huguette's letters from Reno. She wrote to Tade saying, I really want to get back and resume my painting. And then when she didn't hear from him, she sent a telegram. Did you get my letter? I mean, she really, the happiest times of her life were really in his studio, and she took lessons from him for close to 30 years. What was sort of fascinating to me during this period, and I'm rolling you back to my research, as I told you, I got to see all of this material from, Huguette's archives, and I had been in touch during this for almost 2 years at that point with Tade Stika's daughter, Wanda, Huguette's goddaughter. And I called her up and I said, I found this amazing stuff in the archives. There are these pictures of you as a little girl. And 2 days later, she called me back and she said, I thought I'd see if I had anything for you. And because she thinks her father is a genius, she had saved everything. She had his appointment calendars from the 1930s and 40s. They were in Polish. I felt like we were having therapy sessions, because for almost a month, every Sunday night, she would call and translate and read me what she knew. And here's what I discovered. Huguette, this recluse that you've heard about, was painting the town in the 1930s. She was at the Rainbow Room dancing. She was at the World's Fair in 1939. She was seeing operas, ballets, plays. I mean, they were everywhere. And so even if she wasn't in the gossip column, she was not someone who was hiding at home. Now I'm going to create a scene for you. Huguette's taking her painting lesson, and it's on Central Park South, you know, those beautiful windows looking at the park. And she always had morning lessons, but she's really enjoying herself that day, so she lingers on. It turns out that Tade had gotten a call from some young woman who said, you know, I've heard about you, I want to come see your paintings. And the young woman was a model named Doris, and Huguette was still there when Doris walked in, and Tade and Doris was like, and he fell madly in love with the model. So we've got, for a while, he saw both of them. He was with the blonde heiress, he was with the brunette model, and not only did Tade keep notes, but Doris kept notes. I couldn't believe it. They were what I think of as he's with her again tonight. I'm seriously, you know, that I went, you know, Tade was seeing Huguette, so I actually went and picked roses from my mother's house so we could give them to her. She hung in there, she got her man. They got married in 1942. In 1941, though, life changed somewhat for Huguette. She and her family had a place in Santa Barbara. She loved Santa Barbara, and she had wandered into an antique store at one point and fell in love with Japanese, you know, whether it was kimonos and antiques and screens, and she began importing large quantities of Japanese materials. She had also had a dollhouse as a child. She loved dolls. She began collecting dolls as a young woman. She did something that you can interpret it any way you want, and depends on who's interpreting it. There are pictures of her being the madcap debutante, going out in parties with the doll. Now, you can see that. Now, some people would say, oh, she's immature and she's, you know, troubled. And some people could imagine the madcap heiress. I lean on the madcap heiress side. Other people look at things differently. Anyhow, she and her mother were in Santa Barbara when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And I didn't realize this till I began to read about it, but I didn't realize that the whole coast of California was in free fall panic. There were air raids, there was later a submarine that was, you know, Japanese submarine off the shore. It was a total panic time for Huguette and her mother, who had fled World War I, and now they were World War II. And they came back to New York. And Huguette, as you can imagine, the American government was looking at anybody who had imported a lot of things from Japan. And suddenly, the FBI is calling on Huguette and interviewing her, which sent her into a bit of a tailspin. And, in Tade's journals and notes and her mother's notes, another night where I was kind of like startled, Huguette had a breakdown. And this was something that no one knew until I found this out last fall, but she was under doctor's care. She'd lost a lot of weight. She was in very, you know, not great shape for about a year. And while she came back out of that, she was vulnerable after that. She was never entirely the same. But she and her mother had apartments on two different floors at 907 Fifth Avenue. And they had a quieter life. They tried to stay out of the newspapers, but they still had a bit of a life. And then Huguette's mother died in 1963. And then her mother's sister, Huguette's aunt, died in 1969, at which point Huguette stopped going out. And I could never quite figure out exactly what day. I mean, it's always interesting. There must have been one last day where whether she went for a walk or something happened. I could never confirm this, but someone said the chauffeur had a heart attack and she was frightened by the people coming around. But she literally stopped leaving the house. And it was worse than that. It wasn't just that she wouldn't leave the house, she wouldn't let people come see her. Friends, you know, people she'd known all her life, they would call. She said, oh, I have a little cold. Oh, I'm not. She literally isolated herself more and more. And at the same time, she was tremendously hungry for human contact. She would spend hours on the phone with people. She had a doctor, Jules Pierre, who wasn't well, and she called to see how he was doing, and then she became good friends with his wife, who became her best friend, Suzanne Pierre. And at the same time, her half-siblings had long since died, but they had children. And some of the children did try over the years to get in touch. I think you may have read about that. They would you know, call, or they would send flowers, or they would send notes, and Huguette was not interested. I mean, what she would later say to people, that family got their money, why do they want mine? She was always thinking there was some kind of ulterior motive. The last time family members saw her was in 1968. Although she was very fond of one woman, and she's Agnes Albert, who was her half-niece, I think is how you put it. Great-niece, half-niece. There's a chart in the front of the book, I have to tell you, because these family relationships were so complicated. Now, when Huguette had divorced her first husband in 1929, she left everything to her mother. Her mother dies in 1963. Huguette does not want to write a new will. And for almost 40 more years, lawyers are desperately saying, you have to write a will, because if you don't write a will, all that money is going to go to these family members who you say you don't care about. But she was like, she just didn't want to. While she was at home, her sort of conduit for the outside world first was a man named Donald Wallace, who's a lawyer, a very white shoe firm. I found many letters in the files just begging her to write a new will, saying, you keep ignoring me, this is really important, how can I still be your lawyer? And there was also an accountant, Irving Kamsler, who worked for her since 1977, and then when Donald Wallace became ill, Emmanuel Wallace Bach took over her. Now, I have to tell you, neither of these guys were, you know, the big white shoe accounting. They were small practitioners. She felt safe with them, but they didn't necessarily have the expertise to handle what turned out to be a $300 million estate. Flash forward, 1991, Huguette has skin cancer. She, you know, tries for the longest time to pretend that it's okay, and then she finally tells her friend Suzanne Pierre that she has these sores, they won't go away. Suzanne begs the doctor to go see her, and that doctor, Henry Singman, takes one look at her, and she's transported to Doctor's Hospital. Now you can imagine, she's been home alone. When I say alone, it got so bad that, you know, when staff would retire, she would have new people hired, but she wouldn't meet them. So she would literally be in a different room. She'd talk through the door. She had renovations in her apartment. I mean, she really hadn't seen people. In the hospital, several things happened. They immediately realized she was really wealthy. I mean, I have to tell you, I mean, when you see the letters from the hospital, which are part of the records, they were like, oh man, we got a live one here. I mean, and then they did research and saying, we don't think she has a will, and we don't think she has, you know, any relative she's close to. Let's be really nice to her. And she, very early on, her friend Suzanne thought that, you know, a woman of Huguette's stature should have private nurses in the hospital. She shouldn't have to wait for the bell to ring. So she arranges to hire two private nurses, one of them being a woman named Hadassah Perry. Hadassah was Filipino, married to an Israeli cab driver. She'd been a freelance private nurse. And Huguette likes Hadassah, very sweet woman. And she asked Hadassah to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. Hadassah has three young children at that point, but, you know, this seems like a good deal. Hadassah worked that schedule for close to 15 years. And then one of the sadder parts of this story, we're reading Hadassah's three children were deposed as part of the lawsuit. And they, you know, her daughter was crying on the witness stand saying, I didn't have a mother. Because my mother was never, ever there. And Hadassah made that trade-off. It was a very lucrative trade-off. Huguette gave her $31 million. That's the best paid nurse in New York you could imagine. Huguette was selling paintings. Huguette was giving artwork away. There was a period where Huguette began to write checks to Hadassah. Now, you know, you might be really happy if your nurse was nice to you. Maybe you'd give her a bonus. would you write her a $20,000 check in the morning and then maybe another one in the afternoon, like you forgot what you already wrote? I mean, it's kind of it was also one of those things where it began when Hadassah had a flood in her house, and she told Huguette, and Huguette bought her a new house. And then my favorite part was when Huguette bought her a new apartment over at 96th and Park, and Hadassah didn't like the view, so Huguette bought her another apartment. I mean, it was just, you know, Hadassah was like, you know how little kids push you, like, how much can I get away with? Oh, I'll try this. Oh, I'll try that. Hadassah just kept asking, and you know, Hadassah's son at age 7 came and played his little violin for Huguette, and Huguette gave him a $1.2 million Stradivarius, really appropriate for a child. We get up to the year 2005, and Huguette is still doing projects. She's commissioning dolls, she's commissioning doll houses, she has things going back and forth. She's created this whole little world in her room. I should go back a couple of years earlier. Doctors Hospital became Beth Israel. As you may remember, Beth Israel, you know, they ended up shutting it down. Before they shut it down, the hospital, they actually went to Huguette, who had already given them a lot of money, to say, would you like to buy the hospital? It's only $125 million, you know. She didn't think she would, but the hospital and the doctors, in addition to Huguette, the doctors, people learned that anybody with a hard luck story, if they went into that room, you know, had all of us known Huguette, we too could have been beneficiaries of her largesse. Her doctor, he's on the phone with her. He sees her, and he says he's painting his country house. And, you know, she should come see the country house. So that was a really safe invitation for a woman who hadn't left the hospital in 15 years. And she said, you know, it must be expensive. He said, oh, it's $20,000. She sends him a check. I mean, anybody mentioned anything, she would send them a check. Now, when Huguette had sold a painting, she had promised to give Hadassah $10 million. And her accountant and her lawyer said, you can't do that because of the tax consequences. Her lawyer took the Fifth Amendment when he was asked why he didn't pay gift taxes for many years on the largesse that Huguette is passing out to the nurses and the doctors, a largesse that is still left with this estate with $80 million in taxes and fines. But anyhow, Huguette says to Hadassah, I can't give you the $5 million now, but I'll give it to you later. So she actually gives her a check. She can't cash the check. Hadassah has already received at that point $25 million, but she becomes obsessed with this extra five. She got to have it. In 2005, Huguette gets pneumonia. Chris Sattler, her dear assistant, leaves this panic message with Huguette's lawyer, Walsbach, saying, you know, she's really sick, we're really worried. The next message in the lawyer's file is, Hadassah called, she's worried about her money. Tells you the priorities here. Huguette recovers from pneumonia, she's 99 years old, and she still hasn't written a new will. She has agreed to put her Connecticut house up for sale, so what she agrees to do is write a new will that simply says, if I die before my Connecticut house is sold, $5 million goes to Hadassah. And she names her lawyer and accountant the executors. So at that point, Hadassah knows she's getting her money and getting her $5 million, and the lawyer and accountant are relieved because they know they're going to get executor's fees. What they say is it was always meant to be a stopgap will, and that now they've finally gotten Huguette to sign something, that they prepared another will that 5 weeks later she signed. In the first will, had she died and not changed that will, all of the money would have gone to her distant family members other than the $5 million for Hadassah. In the new will, and I have to say, I believe that her wishes in that, I believe the second will represents her wishes. She gave money to Wanda, her goddaughter. She gave money to Chris Sattler, who had worked for her. She set up her her California estate in Santa Barbara as an artist retreat. She gave Mamone to the Corcoran. There were very specific kinds of and she signed that will. Now, little tip to all of you, if you're going to have a 99-year-old woman sign a will, maybe you should make sure that you've got witnesses, maybe you should make sure you videotape it, because part of the problems with whether, you know, those were her wishes is they grabbed a couple, you know, they grabbed a nurse off the hospital floor. He didn't remember. He'd been assisting on a tracheotomy. They brought in the secretary of the lawyer. The lawyer later fired the secretary. The secretary then said that, oh, bad things were happening in that hospital room. She said Hadassah was, you're not supposed to be in the room if you're a beneficiary. She said that Hadassah was in the room and holding Huguette's hand as she signed the will. As I said, Huguette died, and this family launched this lawsuit, which was settled last fall. I want to go back to one thing before I open it up for questions. What I really wondered through all of this, as I was trying to understand Huguette, is, was she happy? You know, I mean, would any of us spend life in a hospital room when we could have had a 42-room apartment, you know, with impressionist art and antiques, $15 million pink diamond and various other, you know, two countries? I mean, she wasn't in the grand wing of the hospital. She was in a good old little hospital room. I was very lucky to meet a woman named Marie Pompey, who Marie was the nurse when Huguette first went into the hospital at Doctor's Hospital. She was the first person who had seen Huguette unclothed and whatever, and they became friends. And even after Marie retired, she would go visit Huguette on many occasions. And she went to see Huguette just a few months before Huguette died. And Huguette had never been religious, particularly her mother was Catholic. When they would offer her, did she want to meet with any of the, you know, any ministers, whatever, she said no. But Huguette said to Marie, let's sing Our Father. And these two old ladies, with their arms around each other, were singing at the top of their lungs, sort of making up music to them. And then the next time when Marie came back, you know, she was talking about how her grandson was getting married. And, you know, maybe Huguette should come to the wedding. And Huguette was like, and have us sing with your bad voice? So she's joking and laughing. And as you remember, Huguette was born in Paris. And Paris were the happiest moments of her life. And when Marie was talking about her grandson hadn't decided where he was going on his honeymoon, Huguette said they should go to Paris. So I think that there were some happy moments in her life, even if it wasn't necessarily a life that any of us would have chosen. To sum up the settlement of the lawsuit, it went on and on and on and on and on. You know, my husband would probably say that our apartment is almost full of legal documents that would fill this room. I mean, it went back and forth and sideways and under, and eventually last September they settled. The family members got roughly $35 million. The lawyers got $40 million. It's really rather amazing. Huguette's estate in Santa Barbara is being turned into an arts retreat. Her possessions were sold at auction. I bid. I lost. And Hadassah was forced to give back $5 million, but no consequences. And the estate is still suing Beth Israel because they feel that Beth Israel should have had her examined by a psychiatrist early on, should not have been allowed to keep her there. It's an interesting, controversial lawsuit because she did live to 105 years old. They took good care of her. Early on, her doctor said, asked her to see a shrink, and she was like, no. They didn't force the issue. What they did do was they lied about the identity of a development person. So, I mean, if you're saying, we want someone from PR to come meet with you, and it turns out to be from development to shake her down for money, they maybe could have found a way that a consulting psychiatrist might have wandered by. I don't know, but I just throw it out. But you know, this again is in the courts. So it was I was sad during some of this because I kept wishing that she had had a different life, but I realized that might have been my life, not hers. And I think at the end of the day, she was happy with many of the things that happened in her world. Questions? Yes.
Some of the stories that were in the press involved enormous estates that were fully staffed during her entire hospitalization, and the maids and people who were the caretakers.
The Connecticut home, they had a caretaker, but she didn't have a full-time staff. In California, for a very long, first thing, she was very generous, so that she kept people on the payroll until they died. And then she'd put their families on the payroll. So she did, thank you. They weren't hiring a lot of new people after a point in time, but the California state did have, there were stories that they were, you know, setting the table for dinner every night. They weren't. I mean, it wasn't that, you know, she wanted things to be kept a certain kind of way. And I was able to go out there in January, which was to see that house, which it's so beautiful and so haunted. The problem with turning it into an artist retreat is nobody's touched the plumbing or the electricity since the 1930s. But it really, it's very beautiful. I mean, one of the things that was a little bit strange, she really did love those dolls. They were a big part of her life, and she took comfort in them. In her bedroom, there are these little half-size chairs circled around for dolls. It's a little bit, but anybody else? Yes. I don't know that. I wonder the same thing. I think he seemed safe, to be honest. I mean, he was a known quantity. They had known him, and I think Anna, who gets mother, may have felt that, you know, she got a dowry when she married, and she wanted to equalize them so he wouldn't feel he had to ask his wife for money every 30 seconds. So, and I think he went in there into this marriage not entirely knowing whether this was. One of the things that was so intriguing to me was they became friends later on, her ex-husband. There was wonderful correspondence for them in the 1970s, and a suggestion they might have had one meeting when he came to town. And she loved to sit up there at 72nd Street, you know, on the 12th floor with her telescope, and she would look at, and then she would take pictures. And so there was a very funny letter from her husband who was in France talking about, you know, could you focus a little on that girl with the bikini? I mean, it was just funny. But, yeah. And next. Yeah.
I just wondered about her own art collections. I know that one of the apartments on 72nd Street that they sold not too long ago had a lot of paintings by her of dolls. And I just, when you say that her possessions were sold, I wondered whether, you know, by the estate, whether those included her own paintings or something else that
They had an extraordinary art collection, some of which she had sold off during the years. There were some paintings that her parents had, you know, purchased, but also Renoirs and Degas and Monets that she had purchased herself. The auction, when I was saying I bid, there was some of her paintings were for sale, and they didn't sell everything. They were there are nudes that she did of herself. They didn't put those in the auction. Her doll collection wasn't in the auction, but there were some Japanese scenes that she did and scenes of Japanese dolls. There were about 6 or 7 paintings in the auction, but there are, I think, about 20 more, and I'm guessing those will eventually become part of the art retreat in Bellas Guardo. Yes?
I have this image in my head of this elderly woman in a hospital bed. Was she in bed in the hospital?
Well, you know, this is what got to me. When I was doing the Brooke Astor book, her nurses told me that Brooke, out of self-respect, dressed for dinner every night. You know, that's what a lady does. She dresses for dinner. So Brooke would put on her evening gown, put her jewels, sit in front of the TV with a TV tray, but, you know, this is what we do. We dress for dinner. Huguette wore a hospital gown for 20 years. Even Hadassah is writing how, I bought her dresses, I bought her outfits. She literally, they would, Chris, her assistant, they wanted her to exercise, so he basically, they made up a little routine, which was, we're going to go for a walk in Central Park. And he would take her arm and walk her around the room, and he would describe the landmarks that she had seen in Central Park. You know, here's the boat basin, and here's the statue. And she left the hospital once in 20 years to go to the dentist, and then another time when they changed her. What breaks my heart is how could you, no fresh air. No, you know, I can understand the no sun in her face because she had really bad skin cancer. But even to be wheeled into a courtyard or just, you know, she didn't like the hospital food, so Hadassah cooked for her. but never a restaurant, never a movie. I mean, I think the hardest thing is, you know, that she wasn't always like that. I mean, that was the surprise when I, because I initially just assumed she'd always been that way, but she really wasn't. She was out in the world. Yes, sir. She left $1 million to Beth Israel, and she left some money to the doctors, but not the guy. She'd already given them a Monet, and she'd given them money through the years. So she sort of cut back her giving to the hospital about 5 years before she died. But there was a steady stream of checks, you know, a couple times a year.
Is that the only hospital she was in?
Yeah. She didn't go to Japan, but she had, yeah, I mean, she didn't travel. She had traveled with her parents to Europe a great deal, but I have no, and he took his first family to all over the world, but I never found anything showing that he had taken to get anywhere but Europe. And I'm sorry, what was the other part? Oh, she went to the hospital in 1991 and died in 2011. So back there, yeah. She was addicted to the New York Times. She loved the New York Times. She loved magazines. She loved European magazines, celebrity magazines, French magazines. She also she had a huge library, and she was always asking for books. And a lot of it was art and architecture and design, both European and Japanese. She read about the Japanese emperor. She really was a Japanophile. She taught herself some of the kanji. I sort of found her practice things. I have to say, one other note that got me, you know, you can imagine me, I'm just sitting there reading through all these things, and I find this, you get saved. She saved everything. She saved 880 pages of scrap paper. You know, by the side of the phone where you write what you're thinking about buying for dinner, what you're trying to doing. When I got to the one which said, my get up and go, got up and went, this is a woman who hasn't left the house. She wrote down the TV shows that she was taping. There's been some confusion about the cartoons, which is that she was trying to teach herself animation initially. So she would take pictures of cartoons, and you know, like the early, and then she would almost put them in, you know, books that you could flip through the books. At the same time, she got kind of hooked by them. I mean, as any of you know, cartoons are often made for the parents just as much as the kids. I mean, I'll still watch Rocky and Bullwinkle. I have to admit, I'm forgetting some of the names of the ones she liked. They wouldn't have been my choice, but she was an avid reader. Yes.
Who is the lawsuit with the hospital? Is the hospital being sued?
They are, by the estate. One of the allegations is that the hospital, some of the people, they hid her. I mean, there was a letter that came up from the development office when they were going to ask Huguette to give money, saying, should we, when they were going to ask Huguette, I think, to buy the hospital, should we tell legal about this? Or maybe if they knew that she was in the hospital all these years, that wouldn't be good for us. I mean, there's some very damaging emails. Well, she said she wanted to stay, but, you know, should they have made her leave? I mean, I could make the case that, you know, it's not appropriate for a hospital to keep someone healthy for 20 years.
How do you have to feel about that? You feel that they should have fought to get her out?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that they should have basically said, we are very grateful, and we will make arrangements for you, and the doctors and the staff are happy to see you on regular occasions, but I don't think it's appropriate for them to have kept her there. And also, there was this sort of arrogance of her doctor saying, you know, she asked to do this, and I decided that this was, you know, the best thing for her. He was a general practitioner. He wasn't a therapist. I mean, he didn't think there was any point in trying to force the issue. And, you know, people said it was never raised again, you know? Yeah. Yes. They did. I mean, that's what she went to the hospital for, yes. And they, plastic surgery afterwards, so it's substantial. And I mean, that's why when I kept finding all these things saying, Daddy, I'm brown as a berry, I thought, oh, you know, this is before SPF 30.
So it was not melanoma?
No. I presume it was, I never saw her medical records, but I'm assuming it was basal cell. Yes. There are two doctors, they're both retired. One of them's name is Henry Sigmund, one is another named Jack Rudick. I sense you're all a bit restless, but I will be signing books if any of you want them. And again, I'm so honored that you came and you're interested, and thank you.